Monday, August 12th, Los Angeles, Scott Frazier, Hayes Davenport, Alyssa Walker calling in. You would think after having so many call-in episodes, we would have some kind of like protocol or that it would get easier, but it's like starting from scratch every time.
Getting harder.
There's always a new set of challenges. Yeah.
Yeah. Like in the city, right? Alyssa, you were telling us before we realized that we had not been recording that it's you're out of town, I guess, to celebrate your LA anniversary.
Yeah, I always leave town to celebrate my LA anniversary or LAniversary, you might call it. I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So I leave, so I recreate how I arrived first in Los Angeles every year. I leave town and then come back. My journey.
Oh, your journey.
By way. There were some other places, but technically, yeah. So I'm in Colorado now, and I'll be recreating my journey on foot this time, though. I'll be walking on the way back to LA.
Oh, wow. It's your 18th LA anniversary.
Yeah. Now I can vote in this week's elections.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. It feels like it's been a little while since we've had an election. I mean, comparatively, it's been like a couple months.
Right. We've slowed down from our breakneck pace of like one every other week.
Scott, you have any stories from this week?
Not really. I've been spending my whole week preparing to go out of town.
Uh-huh.
I'm leaving to France. So
yeah.
I don't know. I really don't have much LA related.
This week, for me, I have been helping out with a friend's city council campaign. Her name is Nithya Raman. You might have seen me tweeting about it a lot this week. She announced her campaign on Monday. Scott is also in the video as well. I don't think we don't want to, and Alyssa is not involved at all. She's a respectable journalist, despite my best efforts to get her involved. I don't think we want to be talking about like this campaign all the time. So I'll probably like hold back on it. But suffice it to say, I think she's a great candidate. And it's been interesting, like being on this kind of side of stuff, seeing like sort of how a campaign works. But that was the big thing that I sort of witnessed this week. But we want to talk about, let's start with a story that has made like national headlines and how it affects what we're doing in LA. So this week, a lot of people were boycotting Equinox, the gym Equinox. It's owned by a guy named Stephen Ross.
And SoulCycle, don't forget.
And SoulCycle, sorry. It's owned by a guy named Stephen Ross, or he's not the majority owner, but he is a very significant owner. And he also runs a development company called Related Companies. And people were upset with Stephen Ross because he was hosting a fundraiser for Donald Trump in Florida. One thing I've never like totally understood about these like really high dollar fundraisers, how can they be so expensive when you're only allowed to donate a certain amount to each candidate?
Isn't it that they are just like donating to the PAC?
To the PAC. But I thought in a lot of the cases, it's like you can get a picture with Trump.
Uh-huh.
I don't think Trump was there necessarily, but for a lot, you know, if you pay like $10,000, maybe those go to the RNC or something.
Wasn't there, I mean, like, isn't there a whole thing where it's like, I remember before Paul Ryan left Congress, like there was this whole thing where he would have these fundraisers and he was only allowed to be involved in specific parts of the evening. So he would like leave stage and then it would be like, okay, now we, not affiliated with Paul Ryan, operating independently, are going to ask you to donate like all this money to.
That's great.
Not Paul Ryan.
Very clean. Something. And when he comes back and takes pictures, he has no idea that those people have donated all this money.
How could he know? Unreasonable to expect that he might know.
But Stephen Ross, I think he lives in Florida. I'm pretty sure he does. But he has a pretty significant impact in LA development as well. What is Stephen Ross doing in LA, Alyssa?
Well, the timing is great because you can go see it go up. It just started. So across from like the Broad and Disney Concert Hall is a development that's been in development for decades, I think. Like it's been a really long time. It's a Frank Gehry designed megaplex, mega development. I don't know what the latest name, Grand Avenue Project. Whatever you called it, the Grand Avenue Project for London. So it's a bunch of residential towers and restaurants and all that other stuff. Probably a SoulCycle and Equinox. And one of the hotel is an Equinox hotel. It's like a place where you just are constantly working out from the moment you step inside the hotel. And it just started going up. And so it's just a funny conversation about if you are going to try to boycott some of these things in New York, they were talking about Hudson Yards. There's this giant, another mega development that they got tons of tax cuts for in the city. It has the Vessel that you've seen, that stair climbing. It's all about working out, I guess, is what he is focused on, just constantly getting people to climb stairs and ride bikes inside. So it was just interesting, the conversation about trying to boycott it, because it's really pervasive, not just his developments, but like his holdings. And he also funds a bunch of like transit think tanks and other things that do good work, you would say, studying the effects of climate and emissions on cities. But so in LA, you'd have to steer clear, I guess, of Grand Avenue forever. And you'd also, you wouldn't be allowed to go to Grand Park, because when the building first started or got approvals, they took money about, I think, $50 million. They asked for $50 million for the development rights and used it to build Grand Park. So right. You can't go there either. No splash pad for you.
Uh-huh. So people, you know, and far from boycotting this development in the city of LA, city of LA has actually been throwing money at it, like they do basically all new downtown hotels. David Zanizer, the LA Times reporter, pointed out that the Grand Avenue project that Stephen Ross is building got $200 million, $198.4 million specifically, in tax incentives from City of LA. We've talked about this before. It's very, very common for them to throw this kind of money at hotels. They're really trying to encourage this development, especially in the lead up to the Olympics. And a lot of people say, well, we, you know, instead of hotels, we need more affordable housing downtown and in all these other neighborhoods. But Stephen Ross is also, and maybe primarily throughout his career, an affordable housing developer. He became sort of an expert at taking advantage of government tax subsidies and actually selling the tax shelters created by affordable housing to wealthy investors. To me, and this is all covered in a great article on Curbed by Patrick Cisson from a few months ago, I think, right, Alyssa?
It was last month, I think. Yeah, the timing was just great.
Yeah, right. Well, to me, my question is, like, what does it mean that we have such a reliance on billionaires? Stephen Ross is worth, I think, almost $8 billion. And these huge, huge mega developers to produce for us this product that is essential for human life. I saw in CityLab, they're basically saying, like, well, you can't like boycott everything Stephen Ross does, or you can't be like too like high and mighty about it because he does produce a lot of affordable housing. But if you said that about, like, say, for example, a pharmaceutical titan, to say like, well, he also creates, like, produces like drugs for people to take, people would be like, so what? That's like even
and
more.
People do say that, and it's never well received. Like, you're absolutely right. Like,
right?
It's not something that totally exculpates you from any kind of responsibility for what you do with the rest of your money and energy and et cetera. You
know? Sure, of course. But I also wonder, like, is the fact that we have these huge for-profit developers doing so much of our affordable housing, is that the way it has to be? There actually is a pretty significant nonprofit development presence in LA, especially in Santa Monica. I think Community Corporation of Santa Monica, something like 5% of people in the city are housed in community corporation units.
Interesting.
And we have like other nonprofit developers as well. Why is it that so much of our development is done by these for-profit mega developers?
Well, this project in particular, The Grand, 20% of the apartments are going to low income, which is above and beyond what they would be required to do, but also, you know, they're getting, you know, tax breaks or whatever from the city. So maybe that was part of the deal. But then you have to look at, like, okay, so 300 or so apartments, and there's also condos for sale. But that's 20% is a significant number, and it's right where we want them. I don't know how we could make that project better, especially since it's in a place that's not really going to, you know, it's literally going up on a park, what was the ugliest parking structure ever in the city of Los Angeles, and adjacent to...
What did they call that parking structure? It was like the Tinker Toy Law or whatever. The Erector Set.
So, I don't know. Of anything you could do, this is the least probably problematic development. You look at something like Hudson Yards, where it's literally just a playground for rich people that took advantage of a low income, it kind of gerrymandered, another great CityLab article, it kind of gerrymandered this certain area that would be used for funding for low income housing and used that to get tax breaks that they shouldn't have probably gotten in Hudson Yards.
I think you could credibly level the same accusations at the Bunker Hill redevelopment project and people have in the past. If we were to look back at the history of Grand Avenue redevelopment, which is something that LA Times did not that long ago, Eli Broad had this article and this little insert that they did. Carolina Miranda had an excellent article about the history of Grand Avenue. But going back to the original urban renewal in downtown LA in from the 60s, 70s to present, the project that is now going up next to where the Walt Disney Concert Hall is, all of that land was owned by the CRALA, the Community Redevelopment Agency, now defunct, which I think in California, redevelopment was oftentimes carried out in such a way where it was difficult to parse who the accountable public agencies actually were, as is the case with a lot of local governance in California and in LA specifically. Like, we had a mishmash of like the mayor and his appointees, city council representatives, sort of a thin veneer of separation between elected officials and the people who were supposed to be running redevelopment, ensuring that it would be not a political operation. But of course, it frequently was accused of being exactly that. I think what Parcel Q or whatever, where the Grand is now going up, which has been vacant for decades at this point, aside from the small parking garage there that people used for jury duty for a long time, that has its roots in the same redevelopment project, which was intended to bring back some of the luster to downtown LA. But I think that you could really credibly say that redevelopment dollars, urban renewal as it was envisioned in the 70s, is not something that any politician in LA would start out a project with like that same set of goals anymore in the 2010s. So we are getting what amounts to a very upscale apartment building and shopping complex. Like you're saying, Alyssa, we are getting 20% of those that will be affordable housing units, which is more than is there currently, frankly. But in terms of what you're asking, Hayes, about like how much is it necessary to actually have private development money be the guiding force in this? I think that the alternative is in a city like Santa Monica, you're coupling very naturally high demand with artificially constrained supply, and then saying, as Santa Monica has done, like they facilitate 100% affordable projects and make it very hard to build almost anything else.
Right.
Like, I think you can actually build larger apartment buildings if they are 100% affordable. That will not necessarily be fundable everywhere. I think Santa Monica, as with a lot of like progressive but also economically more homogenous cities, comes from a place of privilege where they are able to do that without some kind of infusion of private capital, specifically in California, where local governments have generally very little money to work with. That kind of ends up being the root of the issue. If you want to reduce the amount of private development capital that is required, there needs to be additional public funding available, which isn't, generally speaking, there.
Right. I'm not really worried about this development specifically. It's hard to gentrify the lot across the street from Walt Disney Concert Hall, and it's not, there's no displacement involved. It was just a parking lot. Actually, kind of the most anti-Trump parking lot of the last few years, because it's where everyone parks to protest.
Right.
And for the Women's March and everything else downtown. There is a huge senior housing, affordable senior housing complex kind of just across the street by the Colburn School, sort of. But yeah, it's hard to put more economic pressure on the region. 20% is high. I do think, I'm not sure that the subsidies that they're getting from the city has anything to do with that 20%.
I think that's for the hotel, right? I mean, that's obviously hotel money.
Yeah, that's hotel money. And there have been a lot of other projects that have no apartments at all, just hotels that are also getting hundreds of millions of dollars. But dude, seeing all the conversation around Stephen Ross as this multifaceted person who has managed to profit off of not just luxury development, not just exercise bikes, but also affordable housing, as if that was an act of charity for him to do those developments, when that was something that he realized he could make hundreds of, make billions of dollars off of.
And also pouring money into philanthropies or think tanks that study cities. Well, of course, that's what you're going to do with your money when your work takes place in cities, right? I mean, what other?
Yeah.
And of course, you're going to probably give money to Trump because administration has made it very attractive for people to invest in cities with things like these opportunity zones. whatever is going to happen with that in LA. So it makes a lot of sense. They're developer buddies from way back, and his fate is intertwined with the success of this man, whether people in LA really realize it.
Just real quick, did you guys read the LA Times article?
Yes, I know exactly which one you're talking about. I just pulled it up.
The Carla Hall op-ed about...
Oh, no, I thought you were talking about the luxury amenities. We'll talk about that one, too. What was the Carla Hall one?
So this was the, do I have to dump my Equinox membership just because I don't like Trump article? I feel like every so often, whenever there's a call to boycott anybody, there's like a very predictable cycle of events. Like you have, so you have people being outraged because they learn that there is some connection between, for like in this case, it was Billy Eichner, like saying, I'm going to quit Equinox. And then, of course, that caught fire on Twitter. Like people learning that something that is part of their lives is connected to something that they viscerally hate. And then people are like, okay, well, I'm going to boycott that. I don't want to support with my money this thing that is so detrimental and damaging to so many people, in this case, Trump. So that happens. Then it becomes sort of like a cause celebre, like a litmus test of where your politics are on an issue, whether or not you're able to, whether or not you're willing to do this.
On both sides, because people who support whatever is being protested then start throwing their money at this thing that they maybe not even aware of
before. Oh, the Kaepernick Nikes thing. It's like people lighting their shoes on fire, sometimes while they were still on their feet.
Yeah.
So yeah, that happens. Then there's a backlash on two sides. On one hand, you have rich people, in this case, like Carla Hall, saying like, what if I'm just like comfortable with doing this? Stop telling me I can't enjoy creature comforts that come with my lifestyle. And then on the other hand, there is like the more leftist version where it's like, there is no ethical
consumption.
And it's all very tiring and we're all very tired of this narrative. I do think that this is funny. Like the like, can't I just enjoy my Equinox thing? Because it always, to me, whenever this happens, it always seems like the actual question that they want to ask but like are afraid to ask is like, can't I just like do whatever I want with my money and and like not think about it, and also have you, random internet stranger, not judge me for that thing? And it's like, pick any two of those three and you're probably fine. Like the asking for all three is maybe right. Just too much to ask for. I don't know. Like if people you don't know and are never going to meet are judging you, like everybody draws their line somewhere, right? Sure. Like we all are buying things eventually from someone and odds are pretty good that that person is ultimately not a great person. So just like draw your line, but don't also expect that people will not judge you for it in some way, shape or form down the line.
Speaking of judging consumption, the article I thought you were going to talk about, Roger Vincent had an article come out today, Sunday, about, it's very related to the Stephen Ross stuff, about how these new mega developments are sometimes having a little trouble finding tenants or leasing condos, whatever it is. And so now there's basically an arms race to add more and more luxury amenities, some of which you would never have even thought were a part of a normal living experience, like podcast studios.
Right.
This is what one building downtown is thinking of putting in. But basically, this article is so unbelievable. It talks about cabanas on the roof, so many dog parks and all of these developments.
It was just described basically as a must-have.
Like must-have.
You're not opening a new development unless it has a dog park in it.
Libraries that have the books organized by color of the jacket. Movie theaters, just like really incredible amenities to, because they're competing with each other. And of course, spin cycle classes for residents as well. This is like the common theme throughout all this. This article points out, and I think the most important takeaway is that these developments are choosing amenities to seek profitability for higher rents instead of going after smaller, down market residents, like trying to fit more people at a lower cost per person into the building.
Can I just read just like a really small bit of this article?
Yes.
Because Roger Vincent, this is just, I mean, shout out to you. This is fantastic.
Really good.
Okay. So this is our two paragraph quote here. Music from hidden Bose speakers changes with location and intended mood, from classical to pop to dance music, as tenants move on flagstone walkways among heated gazebos, gas Viking brand barbecue stations with tables for group get-togethers, a lap pool for working out, and a round pool flanked by well-appointed blue cabanas where casually clad tenants watch television while poking at their digital devices. It's pretty sweet, acknowledged tenant Kevin Frampton, who was standing in the pool with a can of beer, reminiscing about watching the British Open golf tournament while lounging in one of the haute huts. That is what is opening downtown. I just love that. It's pretty sweet. That's our quote from Man on the Street, Kevin Frampton.
It's really well written because yeah. It could double as the kind of like promotional copy that these developers want. And every single developer is quoted in this article because they want to brag about these
They're
amenities.
Proud of it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, like it says, they're choosing to be able to charge $7,500 a month for a two-bedroom apartment, basically, instead of trying to pack more people into these buildings at a lower cost.
Absolutely. And I think that this is a major problem. I mean, we've talked a lot about, of course, the housing crisis here. We know that actual new housing starts have started to slow down, which is a problem for the housing crisis at large in California, specifically in LA County. But we've talked a lot about the need in Los Angeles to add supply and the need, of course, I think we do it from a perspective of knowing that the cost of housing is also a crucial and primary issue for most Angelenos, more so than new supply. But we have, I think, all said we need to build new apartment buildings, and there is a role for the private sector to play in increasing the amount of available supply here. I think that it is incumbent on people who hold that view that we've espoused to explain how or figure out a way in which things like this do not become detrimental to the actual project of making it so that there are places for people in LA to live. I mean, we talked about...
But it's really easy. The solution is so easy. Look at the amenities. Like, look what they're trying to attract. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't use any of those. Like, where is the on-site childcare?
Yeah.
Where are the playgrounds?
Sure.
Where are the places my kids can rent, like, bikes from, you know, on the ground floor? This is like a complete blind spot for the city. And if you look at places like Toronto and Vancouver, they actually have inclusionary family requirements for like family size condos and also family type amenities. And they have certain checklists that you have to, when you're building a new development, that you can attract a certain amount of families to your units, not just people who want to watch a game in a pool from their cabana or whatever. You know, I mean, it's very clear who they want to attract, and they don't want me or my family to move in there.
Well, yeah, it's designed for young single people to meet someone to conceive a child in.
And then move
and then
to Santa Clarita.
To
I think that the issue is, and this is something that I think we've talked about on here before, and something that I've certainly had conversations with people online about. There is definitely a segmentation in the housing market where you have developers who have it in their mind that it is not just that it is more profitable to go after upmarket tenants, but that it is so much more profitable that they would rather compete within that specific submarket and like make more and more luxury units than to make things that are going to be targeted at the even upper middle class. And that's an issue. If we're talking about increasing supply, we want to make sure that it ultimately, like it's units that are possibly going to be available to the middle class, be available, open up space for people who are in lower income brackets, and not just be like an arms race of providing for the highest of the highest income earners. Mm. I do think that that's a major issue here. And like even when we had about a year ago, this glut of new apartment buildings in downtown that were offering things like 1 month of rent free, and people who are probably more on the pro supply side even than anybody that we've talked to on this podcast are saying like, see, this is evidence that increasing supply works because now all these units are 1/12 cheaper or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, by doing that, you're still targeting a very specific group of income earners, which does not include middle class people who can't afford to say like,
it's not their rents that are getting
they're
cheaper.
Not lowering the rent. They're giving you 1 month free. You still have to be able to pay the same amount of rent that they're asking for in subsequent months. Otherwise, like, you're not going to live there, basically. So I think that is a major issue with what we're seeing. And that's where we have the discussions about like the so-called missing middle housing that is naturally affordable and not in these luxury skyrises.
One detail I want to pull out from this article about the dogs, about how they're working so hard to get people into these are luxury apartments. That word is kind of thrown around loosely, but these actually are luxury apartments. Developers want young people with dogs in these units so badly. And among people who are homeless, the biggest obstacle to getting into an apartment is having a dog.
Right.
These beloved companions are keeping them out of lower income housing. Let's get into the funniest and craziest story of the week, I think. So during the Woolsey fire, in the aftermath of the Woolsey fire in like the Malibu and North Valley area, last year, the LA Fire Department put out an after-action report where they sort of evaluated their response and talked about some of the factors that complicated it. And one of the complicating factors that they said impeded their ability to respond quickly was a significant number of requests by political figures to check on specific addresses of homes to ensure their protection. And the LA Times, specifically Jacqueline Cosgrove, saw that line and said, huh,
yeah.
I would sort of like to find out who those political figures were who were making these significant number of requests. She looked into it. It turns out that one of those political figures was Mayor Garcetti. What exactly was it that happened, Alyssa?
Well, you remember during the we all remember during the fire, there was a lot of this idea from Malibu homeowners in particular that the fire department should be coming to save their home or helping mm-hmm. them, particularly, you know, a lot of these wealthy homeowners were doing the same thing, like calling 911 or whatever number to be like, oh, you have to go look at my house. You have to go save my house. And of course, with a bunch of very wealthy homeowners in a very small area, not just in Malibu, but on the other side of the hill as well, they have to kind of pay attention to these requests and filter out who's actually in danger and who's not in danger. But this kept coming up in every press conference during and after the fire. They kept saying this, please do not be contacting us, asking us to check on particular buildings. It's going to really slow down our response. They were already down many firefighters because they had sent a bunch of fire teams up north to help with the campfire and other fires that were happening up north. So they didn't have enough people to address the problems that they were already confronting out there in the field. So any type of request like this, like a favor, or go look at my house, or can you go get my dog, or something like that, could really have slowed down and caused another house to have been destroyed if they were going to check on a particular address. So the call was coming from inside the house, I guess, is what you're saying.
And this was also on the morning of November 9th, the day when the fire exploded.
Yeah.
Like, this was not when, like, they were, in, like, containment was increasing or whatever. This is when it was fully out of control, reaching the beach, basically, in Malibu. The quote from Mayor Garcetti's representative, Alex Commissar, is, Mayor Garcetti asked for information about Bell Canyon and West Hills because both communities were threatened by the wildfire, evacuated and protected by Los Angeles City firefighters, and he knows residents in both communities. That to be coming from your spokesperson is a little crazy. The idea that, like, you're the city that you are the mayor of, your interest in certain neighborhoods is that you know some guys personally.
And how bad does Malibu feel now? I mean, none of them got checked on by the mayor, so they must feel
because they have a different mayor.
So good.
That's the question. Who is he trying to find out there?
Well, so this is like the big issue now.
But the Bell Canyon one, wasn't that Ventura County? It wasn't even in LA County.
That is correct.
Oh, wow.
So that was what I thought was really interesting. Yes. Checking on not even your constituents per se, which was
just
why I would think that would create uproar in Malibu.
LA County resident, yes.
Yeah.
So here I was thinking that he was just picking and choosing his favorite people among his constituents.
No, that was a Ventura County area.
Yowza.
But I mean, to be clear, it does seem like if the LA Times is persistent about this, it seems likely that the city of LA could be ordered to disclose more information than they have been forthcoming with so far, because the Times representatives have already said this is clearly not a request that was being made as just some guy.
Yes.
It's a request that was being made by the mayor to firefighters. And if it were just coming from some guy, they wouldn't have done it. So it's clearly a public record.
Yes. And now they're withholding the address to protect privacy issues. God forbid someone find out who a mayor is friends with who lives in Ventura County. But there's a quote in the article by Jacqueline Cosgrove from consumer watchdog president Jamie Court, not to be confused with Jamie McCourt, saying that the request is absolutely public record. Taxpayer money was financing the efforts of firefighters and police officers during the fire. And Jamie Court says he didn't ask his babysitter to check. He asked the fire department. And if he wasn't mayor, no one would have checked. I'd sort of argue that asking his babysitter to go into the Woolsey fire to check on a friend's house would maybe be more ethically complicated. But we actually have some of the texts in the article. There are 56 pages, apparently, that got released, and we can only see some of them. We would not be talking about anything else on this show if we had all 56 pages. It would just be a live reading
of the
text. But he gets a message, I believe, from the fire chief, Ralph Terrazas, yes, that says, Mayor, LAPD is canvassing Bell Canyon to assess damage. I anticipate it will take a few hours. Do you have a specific address we can check for you? And Garcetti sends just the address, which is blacked out. And the fire chief replies, got it. It's also notable that LAFD, the fire department, went in and corrected the after action report and the part that said too many politicians were requesting check-ins on specific addresses. They said afterwards that was a mistake or something, and that wasn't actually an issue, I assume, because this same text chain got a little more activity after that after action report went out. I wonder if those texts are available as well. There's also a quote in here from Assistant Chief Tim Ernst that I thought was kind of interesting. He said, this was just in the aftermath of the fire. He said, one of the things I really wanted to mention, especially to the newer chiefs in the room, is that living in the city of LA or the county of LA, we have to understand we probably have some of the wealthiest communities in America. And with that comes a certain amount of political power. So it's something he thinks that you just have to know going into this job,
right,
is that you are going to be pushed to literally put out fires for the wealthiest people in the city before everyone else. I don't know. Alyssa, do you know anything about the next steps of this? The LA Times, I know, is pushing to get this address or these addresses released.
Well,
right?
Yeah, I mean, these are hard. We've talked before about, you know, public record requests and how, look how long this has taken. We're in fire season again now. But it's very difficult to prove that you should have something put in the public record, especially when it's already been redacted like this. I don't know how easy it's going to be for them to argue that this is in the public interest, but it's clear that they don't want us to know it. So that should at least raise some eyebrows. And I hope the LA Times is out there trying to figure that out.
Because it would take a judge probably, right?
You could go through a whole, I mean, I guess the office could decide that they are going to release them or release some, but also it's one gated community. It's very specific about the one gated community where the house is burned, so it wouldn't be that hard to probably just try to figure out what the level of
we're
interest
going
was.
Out there. I agree with
go
you, Alyssa.
Go out and drive
this
around
week,
for yes, a little bit.
Field trip. Tomorrow, as you're listening to this, there is an election, special election in Council District 12 in the Northwest Valley. We've talked about it a little bit. It's Lorraine Lundquist. She's an environmental scientist who teaches at Northridge against John Lee, the chief of staff of the former council member Mitch Englander, who left that office to become a sports lobbyist. Interestingly, as Emily Alpert Reyes, the LA Times reporter, pointed out on Twitter this week, This is a Democrat versus Republican race.
Mm-hmm.
John Lee's a Republican. Lorraine Lundquist is a Democrat. Should be pretty cut and dry for a lot of our local elected officials, whether they be Democrat or Republican. However, a lot of council members are staying out of this race.
Yep, entirely.
At least four Democrats have yet to weigh in on this. Gil Cedillo, Curran Price, Mitch O'Farrell. Shockingly to me, Jose Huizar, nobody's asking for that. So that I totally understand. And Mayor Garcetti has not endorsed either. They've all stayed out. Herb Wesson and Nuri Martinez endorsed on Friday and Saturday.
Yeah.
Days
before the election.
Before the election. And Monica Rodriguez and Joe Buscaino have endorsed the Republican.
Yeah.
Supervisor Catherine Barger.
Catherine Barger,
who is a Republican.
Greg Smith, who's Councilmember Bosch, who is currently occupying the seat.
You know, I think you really cannot discuss the LA City Council without just commenting on the truly remarkable inter-party comity that exists on that body between all of its elected members. Of course, the 99.5%. 99.99% unanimous vote record that they have displays that they really are, they're in accord on most issues, regardless of party affiliation. And I do think it's very interesting that I think we have a candidate in Lorraine Lundquist who is, she's progressive on a number of issues. She is potentially, I guess, stands to break up some of that unanimous lockstep voting by being to the left of the prevailing council opinion on a number of issues, such as LA's Green New Deal, saying that is that it doesn't go far enough. Whereas John Lee actually thinks that it goes too far, but we have city council members who are more willing to co-sign that. And I think that is, it's just weird. It's maybe just a vote from them in favor of the status quo, which allows them to preserve a lot of their own provincial interests rather than having to engage in discussion about how they should operate. I really can't explain it in any other way.
To your point, Alyssa, about the supervisors, there are 4 out of 5 Democrat supervisors, and I believe only one has endorsed.
I think so too.
Lorraine Sheila Kuhl, as far as I can tell, right. either they came in very late or have stayed quiet on it. Hilda Solis.
Is this usually so late? I mean, does it seem exceptionally late for these endorsements to come out?
Incredibly late.
Kuhl and Barger are the two whose supervisorial districts intersect with CD12. So it makes sense that they would weigh in. In my mind, the other supervisors saying nothing is kind of not that remarkable. But the city council members.
The supervisors they overlap with the city council in their duties so much. True. I think it is weird to stay out of the race.
It does seem like it would be a very easy endorsement to make.
Just a layup. I think a huge part of it is entrenched interests who have carved out a position against Lorraine Lundquist and vice versa, who she has spoken out against, like SoCal Gas, like the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, who we've been talking a lot about recently.
Yep.
Lundquist is promising to close natural gas plants, to shut down Aliso Canyon, the well in the North Valley that caused the biggest environmental devastation since Deepwater Horizon. IBEW specifically is putting out mailers that are basically red baiting, not basically, like fully red baiting this election. They're playing up Lorraine Lundquist's endorsement from the Democratic Socialists of America, talking about how she wants to force you to give up your car and replace it with an electric car, about how your electric bills are going to go up by over $3,000 a month if you vote for Lorraine Lundquist. These are very powerful entities in LA politics, and it's hard to imagine that this doesn't have something to do with the fact that so many Democratic politicians are choosing not to get involved in this.
Well, also it's kind of a way to endorse or not endorse bus rapid transit, because the John Lee has become very, very opposed to this BRT line that's going, that Metro actually just announced the alignment for this week, that their proposed alignment, the preferred alignment that will go, right by Northridge, right by CSUN Northridge, and go, to the places it needs to go to. And he came out again and said how against he is to bus rapid transit as well as road diets. So you can just look at the council members who are going to endorse him and realize that probably bus rapid transit, road diets, any kind of street safety is probably not going to happen in those districts as well. Just guessing.
No, that's absolutely true. I think that so John Lee has made that basically the entirety of his campaign.
In the second half, basically, really started to get after it.
Yeah. I will stop this bus rapid transit thing, which Lorraine Lundquist has not said, because she is like the environmental climate science. She's that candidate.
She hasn't chosen a route for
There's not a reason to do it,
right?
As a candidate, if you're opposed to the project happening at all, it makes sense to try and make the campaign entirely about that. But from the perspective of what Lundquist is saying, and what you would hope that elected officials who are already in office in LA would back her up on, is LA needs to do more to move away from fossil fuels. It needs to do more to shore up our climate resiliency as a region. And the fact that you have John Lee basically winking at like climate denialists, catering to the vote of people who are saying like LA's Green New Deal goes too far, that to me, that we can't actually have the Democrats who sit on the council be supportive of the candidate who is in favor of the Green New Deal is bad. That's really bad. Yeah, that should, as you said, be a layup.
But it's another example we've been talking about a lot in the last few weeks of fossil fuel interests, whether they be utilities or unions, mobilizing in response to efforts to decarbonize Los Angeles and the country.
Yeah.
Like, they've been making news. They're a lot more active right now.
They're not going to, I mean, if you are a politician in LA and you think that fossil fuel interests are just going to roll over and die without a fight, like, none of this plan is going to get enacted if that's what they're hoping for.
Yeah. If Lorraine Lundquist is to win on Tuesday, it would be the first time a Democrat is occupying that city council seat in decades. It's basically been a handoff from council member to chief of staff to their chief of staff, et cetera, for a really long time.
Right.
And she would become the third out of 15 council members who is female. It's a big one, except for the fact that it is going to be run back probably no matter what happens in 2020. I think there's a chance that maybe John Lee would not run again if he lost, because probably the electorate would be somewhat farther left in a higher turnout election. But I imagine if Lorraine Lundquist lost, especially if she lost in a close election,
she would absolutely come back out. Yeah.
Yes. Let's check back in on USC. It's been a little while since we've talked about the story of dozens and dozens of women filing claims that the USC gynecologist, George Tyndall, raped and abused them when they went into his office. And now 48 male patients say that a USC doctor abused them as well. This was an article reported by Sasha Urban at BuzzFeed about Dr. Dennis Kelly, who subjected these patients to invasive exams and made sexual remarks, the article says. And the article also talks about how USC once again was warned about this and had many opportunities to do something about it that they did not take. Scott, what are the details?
Right. So this is something that was first reported in February of the current year by Matt Hamilton and Harriet Ryan, who have been deep in the USC beat for a long time now, just uncovering horrendous scandal after scandal. Mm-hmm. The news that was reported in BuzzFeed today.
I want to say, yes, the initial reporting
was from the LA Times.
Was from the LA Times, but it was about a single instance.
Correct. Yeah. So we have, I think there were actually six accusers at that point in time in February.
Oh, yes. And only one had complained to the university.
Correct. That's right. So now we have the continuance of that lawsuit that was filed against USC, alleging that they had knowledge of criminal behavior by Dennis Kelly, the now retired doctor at the health clinic on campus there, that they had covered up actively that misbehavior and that they were endangering students. So now BuzzFeed is reporting that they have successfully found more accusers in this case. There are now 48, as you said. Now we have specific allegations of wrongdoing that are very horrifying. I mean, as we're reading through this complaint that was filed against USC, it is shocking how similar it is to the George Tyndall case.
Across the board.
It's extremely similar. We're talking about patients being denied basic, like, modesty covering while they were in Kelly's office, him making extremely lewd and presumptuous and, like, really just over the line, would never be acceptable in a general medical context questions.
Mm-hmm. Targeting certain groups in the way that Tyndall was reported to target Asian students. The Dennis Kelly apparently went after gay and bisexual men.
Exactly. Yes. I believe all of the accusers belong to the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. And the, I mean, there are allegations that range from asking whether or not an accuser ever let his partner come in him to forcible insertion of foreign objects
without warning.
And yeah,
same for George Tyndall across decades.
And with the university having received complaints and having done nothing, this is covering much of the same time period as the George Tyndall cases, when Tyndall was preying on young women, Kelly was preying on young men. This is the same Student Health Services Center. That is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you attended USC during this period of time, there were multiple active sexual predators operating out of the health center, and the university did nothing and had reason to believe that this was the case.
Dennis Kelly also worked at UCLA before USC. This is maybe the most shocking thing. We don't really know exactly what went on at UCLA, but from 1990 to 2002, Kelly worked there, but his employment was severed. UCLA, he described himself as unhappy and dissatisfied at work. It's unclear exactly what happened, but there was a settlement that happened there that is basically an NDA over everything that went on.
Yeah. And then following his term at USC, he continued to see patients at Cal State Northridge.
Boy.
And USC Northridge said USC never alerted them to any issues with any potential issues with Kelly. He continued working there until the original lawsuit was filed back in February, at which point they terminated his services with them. At USC, he worked up until retirement. He just left on his own terms. Much like George Tyndall. This is like beyond, I mean, it's just like not sufficient to say it is a troubling trend. It is like clearly the way that the administration does and has operated there. It gives safe harbor for sexual abusers.
But Alyssa, is there anything left really to do at USC? I mean, is this like sort of a double jeopardy case where everyone who has been held accountable from the George Tyndall episode has been fired, and like, you know, beyond Dennis Kelly personally not being able to work and hopefully going to prison, these allegations are proven true. What's kind of left to do at USC?
Yeah, I mean, how many more cases can they go through at this school right now? There's so many challenges the school is facing, and to be noted, the reporting that unearthed this was something called the Beacon Project, which is out of the Annenberg School, the journalism school there. USC's own journalism school has a program for its students to investigate problems surfacing at the school, which I think is also kind of amazing and shows at least someone there is really paying attention to.
Well, the students have to defend themselves if nobody else is going
exactly,
to, right?
Right. You're having these, you know, these rising juniors and rising seniors investigating these incredibly disturbing topics that are coming out of the school. And I think it's a good testament to somebody there is paying attention and trying to unearth these truths and make sure that it can become a place that's safe for students to go and for faculty to work in. But yeah, how can this keep happening, this again and again, this cycle that we're going through?
I think this does kind of underscore, I hope, just how much the world and the culture of reporting abuse has changed since even 2016, where I think many more students now, if they went to the health center and the doctor asked them how much porn they watch, which was a common question from Dennis Kelly, like that alone would be enough for them to like try to go to some higher up and say, hey, this person asked me this really inappropriate question. And that would possibly be enough on its own to get somebody fired. And that would extend to higher ups at the university as well. I would think like, hey, this could be a real issue for us liability wise. We have to get rid of this person right now. Again, maybe I'm naive, but I would have to think that something has changed in the way these processes are handled.
I think that aside from what you're saying about like double jeopardy, we know that this time period overlaps significantly with the period of time in which George Tyndall was active and abusing women at USC. That being said, there needs to be public accountability. I think that a lot of the issues that USC has had over the past couple decades stem from a lack of public accountability, and there definitely needs to be a thorough investigation, whether it's by USC or someone else, into what were the steps that USC took? What did it do with information? Like, we, I think, really need USC officials on record as saying this is how this was handled and not just claiming ignorance, which is generally what they've done in the past. Of course, they've taken steps to ameliorate that going forward, but that doesn't mean that we don't need more thorough accounting for what happened for this 20-year period.
Yeah, and there's a really shocking timeline in the article. Dennis Kelly's employment did extend very late and basically only ended when the Tyndall investigation came out as a result of LA Times reporting. He was up for review to have his contract extended as recently as 2017, and he was rehired, and people were still complaining about him after that and being told that their complaints, either not getting a response for over a year or being told that their complaints could not be determined because there were no medical records associated with what they were talking about. I mean, that goes into 2018.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's
wow.
very, very recent stuff. And it's incredibly clear at this point that George Tyndall and Dennis Kelly would still be working yep. if not for the LA Times, if not for Harriet Ryan and Matt Hamilton and the other reporters that have covered these stories. One final note from this week, you might have read
the Forbes article about a month ago. Forbes came out
celebrating that Kanye West has solved the housing crisis.
Yeah.
He had plans for structures designed after, what are they like?
They're supposed to look like the farmhouse on Tatooine.
On Tatooine, yes.
Luke Skywalker's
yes,
home.
Yes. He was building them in Calabasas. He had plans to build these very affordably. And a list of what happened to this utopian community this week.
like every utopian community that's being constructed secretly in the city of Los uh-huh. Angeles. Well, actually, this was in Calabasas,
yes, right?
So, which is probably even more stringent yeah. when it comes to building permits. But yeah, somebody reported him, like anybody, like probably is going to happen a lot. If you're putting on an addition, your neighbors don't like construction noise, you call it in and someone comes out and from building and safety and shuts you down. And that's exactly what happened. He was building this on some land. It's his property, but like it's not his house. He lives nearby in Hidden Hills, but not in this particular area. But he guess has this he has this land to build this utopia, but no
this
longer.
This is a story that is near and dear to my heart. Kanye West, it has been ever since Coachella, has been doing some really weird stuff just below the notice of the mainstream media, at least as far as like compared to his normal.
Yeah, he's really flying under the radar. Well, there's
past the Trump comments, he's been now under the radar where he is holding these Sunday services uh-huh. every week in Calabasas on the same property. He is building what sounds sort of like a space, like a little Epcot themed commune where he would potentially allow homeless individuals to live. If you are thinking about this, it sounds to me a lot like Wild Wild Country.
I was going to say Koresh, but yes.
It sounds a lot like Wild Wild Country. He owns this property. The city of Calabasas does not like that he, or the people who live in Calabasas don't like that he is putting up these houses, these temporary structures on his land. The next step seems like it would be to, as happened in Wild Wild Country, invite a bunch of homeless individuals to yep. come live on that property and then have them vote in the city of Calabasas elections and kind of just take over the city of Calabasas. It does seem like he's starting a cult out in Calabasas.
That the documentary I want to see is Kanye West versus Calabasas resident Jill Stewart, who fights development all over the city
right.
and suddenly gets it brought to her doorstep.
Yep.
Could have been the whistleblower. Yeah. She could have been the whistleblower. You never know.
This is also connected to my other favorite story from this week, Emoji House.
Emoji House.
Which is, everyone saw it, the house in Manhattan Beach where a woman got in a fight with her neighbors about some very petty property issue.
Yeah.
And in response, had someone come in and paint emojis on her house that apparently are
infuriating Manhattan Beach residents.
Yes, and also maybe targeting one of her neighbors who has eyelash extensions, which were one of the features of the emojis.
I just love that. I think we talked very recently about that op-ed that was like, Weird LA is disappearing.
Yeah.
And now I have to say, nobody actually misses Weird LA because this shit is weird. The Emoji House and also Kanye's like cult out in the desert.
Yeah.
They're both very weird and no one is happy about it.
I am. The article's great. I like how the complaints about Emoji House, one of them includes that so many tourists are coming in to get a picture in front of Emoji yeah. House, a problem that is now going to be made much worse
right.
by the new coverage. This is made like yeah. national news, Emoji House, and the coverage being driven by these complaints.
Right.
The street is going to turn into just a total nightmare for everyone living there.
Could not happen to a better group of people.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it for this week. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. We will be back next week on LA Podcast. Bye-bye.